We need big, bold action, and Speaker Pelosi and I are working very closely together on putting together a very strong plan, which you will hear shortly. The people like McConnell and McCarthy and even Trump who say, let's wait and do nothing, well, they remind me of the old Herbert Hoovers. We had the Great Depression. Hoover said, just let's wait it out. It got worse and worse. We need Franklin Rooseveltian type action, and we hope to take that in the House and Senate in a very big and bold way.
That was Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer talking to MSNBC's Stephanie Ruhla about Democratic plans to start getting really serious about coronavirus bailout stimulus after the paltry first $3 trillion or so that has walked out the door from Washington. Hello, people with ears, and welcome to the Reason Roundtable. I am Matt Welch, joined by my illustrious colleagues, Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Hi, Herbert Hoovers.
Howdy.
Hey, Matt.
Happy Monday.
We are going to talk about what might come next at us from Washington. But first, let's catch up bullet point style with where we're at with COVID-19 and the effects and responses thereof. U.S. death count now north of 80,000. A week ago, 68,000. Worldwide deaths at around 285,000. Confirmed cases in the U.S. are above 1.3 million, and it's more than 4.1 million worldwide. Both the daily death count and the daily new cases rate are flattened in the U.S., which is very good news, while testing continues to increase, which is also good news. But that data is still pretty heavily skewed by where Nick and I sit here in New York City. That's going down fast, but around the rest of the country combined, stuff is going up still. Speaking of going up, unemployment numbers are ghastly at a likely undercounted 14.7% and rising very fast. So, Nick, if we were playing a drinking game during Chuck Schumer's clip there, we would be even drunker than we are right now.
Yeah, I would be drinking some Great Depression era bathtub gin.
Watch out for that Jake leg.
Herbert.
There is so much wrong with what Chuck Schumer just said there that it, you know, it would take an infinite, you know, multiverse to actually catalog stuff. But just for the beginning aspects of it, yeah. For the beginning parts is that, you know, Herbert Hoover didn't do nothing during the Depression. He tried, he was spinning, hitting, slapping. He was doing a bop it, a public policy bop it, like a madman. All of it was terrible. And then Roosevelt came in and you know, openly, explicitly stated he was going to do bold, persistent experimentation. That was what the New Deal was. It was just a constant throwing of spaghetti against the wall to see what would work. None of it worked. This is the economic history of the Great Depression that needs to be, you know, finally recognized and understood, is that the New Deal did not solve the Great Depression. It extended it. And when you read something like Amity Schlaes's revisionist history of the Great Depression from a decade ago, that is the main message. And it is broadly understood to be an accurate reading of what happened. By constantly trying new things, the government did not help end the Depression. It extended it. And that goes into World War II. And when you talk to people like Russ Roberts, he will say that even the supposed magic of stimulus spending, you know, during World War II, it was actually, it led to a world of rationed goods and you know, just terrible lifestyle choices. So Schumer is wrong about basic metaphors and basic facts. And then the idea, I wish on some level that Trump and the Republicans were doing nothing, because that would at least give us something to counter what we're seeing, which is just a massive rush of money out the door, most of it going down the drain. And we don't know. And when you have politicians saying, you know, we've just pumped $3 trillion into the economy, most of it hasn't even gone out yet. We don't know what it will do. But now is a good time to double, triple, quadruple our efforts. It's mind-blowing. This is a time for rational, kind of discussion of what might work or how it would work, not, you know, setting everything on fire.
Catherine, you know, at least the WPA, I think it was back on in during the New Deal, the Works Progress Administration put up some pretty good murals, you know, some frescoes, I think, right? No, like there was stuff to look at. I'm struck here. We're at $3 trillion. That's not a hyperbolic assessment of the dollar amount that's been approved in Washington. And it reminds me of during the bailout and stimulus, especially the stimulus in 2008, 2009, occasionally then President Barack Hussein Obama would say things like, you know, where's our, we used to build things like the Golden Gate Bridge. You know, remember there's a whole argument about like, should we build a tunnel between New Jersey and New York? And I think it was Chris Christie who said no, because he likes bridges instead. And people like, I can't believe we don't build things anymore. How is it that we could have just earmarked or whatever $3 trillion and people don't feel like they got any of it? Does money from the government actually do anything? Where does it go, Catherine?
Money from the government does less than other money. That's a thing about government money, is that it is sluggish and stupid, and it goes the wrong place for a while before sometimes ending up in the right place, but only accidentally, often. So the result of that is that you do get this widespread sense, both on the part of individual people, but then also on the part of the people handing out the money, that this is not going very well. So like the last week, we saw a whole bunch of conversations about, oh, wait, hold on. So if you keep your job and your job is subsidized by the PPP program through your employer, you also get this other check for $600 or $1,200 or whatever it is. But if you lose your job and you get unemployment, maybe you don't get that check. Wait, is that fair? And that's the kind of question that should have been asked earlier. They should have thought of that before. And we're seeing it everywhere, micro and macro. So the airlines, of course, got hugely bailed out. They got subsidized loans. They got the whole package. And one of the terms of that was that they kept flying. And now people are furious that the airlines are flying with people on the airplanes. And by the way, they're also furious that the people who don't want to get the airplanes can't get their money back, even though their airlines are flying. It's just every single aspect of this money is fettered with stupid rules. It is poorly thought out. There's such a massive amount of money. And this is how it always goes. This is how the stimulus packages went after the 2007-2008 crisis. This is how it always goes. And no hate to your murals, Matt, but like the WPA artist program is a great example of stimulus money being used stupidly. It was not actually a good way to stimulate the economy to be like paint stuff on post offices.
Yeah. I mean, like at the end of that, America got a bunch of t-shirts that were like, we spent the 1940s equivalent of $3 trillion and all we got were these stupid murals, right? It's the same.
And the Timberline Lodge, Portland, Oregon, near Mount Hood. Come on.
I love when you know, it's pretty easy to see WPA era works. And in Philadelphia's Fairmount Park, there's a great series of statues to all of the great heroes and icons of American history, like the laborer and the preacher and all of this. And the one person, of course, who's missing is the filthy capitalist. But it all is kind of Soviet style because, you know, there was an international art style. The WPA is something to be avoided. But thankfully, we don't need it either, right? We have Netflix, we have Amazon, we have people who paint murals. We call them graffiti
artists.
Banksy
out there doing like, sterile intra-hospital mural placement this week or something?
I just hope it's not finally revealed that he's, he's a member of the British royal family or something like that.
Don't we kind of know who Banksy is? Isn't that one of those known-ish unknowns?
Yeah, but is he like, is he just like, my name's
Biff Henderson?
The identity
of Banksy, like the eventual placement of government money, is unknown. Who is Banksy? Where does government money go? What happens
same.
To it?
These are the
questions we can't answer.
Peter, you, however, are great at answering specific questions about bills and laws in Washington and things. And I would alert listeners to re-listen to your great rundown of the first four phases. Was that last week that you did that, or the week before? I think it was last week.
Time doesn't exist anymore, if it ever did.
Thank you. Good point. I think Nick's going to get into psychedelics a little bit later, but beyond what he is already experiencing. But can you give us a very rough sketch about the competing visions and concepts, and at least politics, about what phase five is shaping up to be, or at least?
So it's starting to sound like a Florida condo development.
Just phase four, because the last two bills are a combined phase three. The CARES Act, that's the $2.3 trillion bill. And then what we followed that up with, what some people have referred to as phase four, but is now mostly being referred to as something like phase 3B or phase three part two.
God, it's so good that we are not together in the booth, because I know you're not supposed to kill the messenger, but like the thing you just described makes me homicidal. Sorry,
again,
go ahead.
It's exactly the same argument that we had over the naming scheme of the last two Avengers films, where for a long time they were like, it's Avengers three and Avengers three part two. And then they were like, well, it's actually Avengers three and four, but they're like a two-part movie. And then they were like, no, actually it's just Avengers Infinity War and Avengers Endgame, and they're sort of the same. But now we're like, what is the next thing going to be? And as with the Marvel Universe, which really is a useful and controlling metaphor here, it's all kind of up in the air, but it's probably going to come down the pike at some point. And there are several big picture arguments here. One is what we've talked about already, and that's just the scale of the deficit. It's going to hit $4 trillion this year. This would be a very different argument in a different debt and deficit scenario, one in which both parties, but Republicans in particular, in some ways, hadn't run up debt and deficits in good times, in which we didn't already have $24 trillion or so in debt, in which we weren't already expected to have trillion-dollar deficits back before the pandemic was a thing that people were talking about or thinking about at all. You know, and so I have some sympathy for Republican wariness here. $4 trillion is an incredibly huge number. If you think about the last crisis, the Great Recession, we never exceeded more than about $1.5 trillion in deficits. And those deficits were very, very large. Running up deficits as we already have, much less any further, could do bad things to interest rates, could constrain fiscal policy in the future. On the other hand, as I've said before, if there is ever a time for emergency deficit spending, maybe isn't it now? Problem is, we did it. We did huge deficit spending on a non-emergency basis for so long. So the next argument is, if there is a next package, what's going to be in it? And I think there probably will be at some point, but right now it's kind of in limbo. And so Republicans are focused on a couple of things. They want a payroll tax cut and liability limits for business owners who reopen. I'm not sure either of those things are good ideas. We've done payroll tax cuts in the past. They aren't really targeted towards the people who end up needing relief the most, because you have to be working in order to get those benefits. And liability limits for business owners, I really can understand why Republicans would want those. It's going to be very hard for business owners to open up right now. There are big legal questions. At the same time, what we want to do, I think, is put the locus of responsibility on opening safely on a bunch of individuals. And that means the combination of people who are working and people who are employing people, rather than simply say, well, these people don't have any actual liability or have very limited liability. And so I do think that there are concerns with both of those things. Democrats, on the other hand, have put together a bill in the House that is probably going to end up being the starting point for any future stimulus or relief bills. And right now they have a $1.2 trillion bill that is mostly a bailout for state budgets. And the big argument about that is the one that we've already talked about, which is whether that money can be used for pension programs. And Republicans aren't going to want to allow that money to be used for pension programs. But it's also very true that state budgets are going to be severely constrained because of increased demand for, say, Medicaid benefits, other kinds of welfare relief programs that get used during crises like this, and because there's just going to be dramatic drops in tax revenue with all of these people out of work. So that's sort of that's the kind of the main front. And then finally, there is what I want to call the backdoor UBI caucus.
Please don't call it that.
There's a whole bunch of folks.
Isn't that on the Doors covered that on their first
It's a whole category on Pornhub. Go.
There's a whole bunch of folks in Congress right now who are looking to create systems that are UBI-like. And so there's a proposal from Kamala Harris, Bernie Sanders, Ed Markey, all Democrats in the Senate, for the federal government to provide $2,000 a month for every individual earning less than $120,000 a year, including children and other dependents. And that would just be semi-permanent until the public health emergency is lifted, and it's not clear exactly what that would entail. Then there is the Josh Hawley bill that, in some ways, makes I hate to say this, if we had done nothing at all right now, if we had not yet passed any bills, I think that an approach like this would make more sense than any of the others, which is not to say that I fully endorse it. But his bill says the federal government should cover 80% of wages for workers for U.S. businesses up to about the median wage of about $33,000 or something like that. And so it is just, let's keep people attached to the labor force. Let's use government money to do that. I believe the 6-month cost for something like that is estimated to be around $600 billion or so. It's less than $1 trillion. And so if we had just done that to begin with, which is what Denmark and the UK did, then we would have spent an awful lot less money and probably would have much lower unemployment. And then you also have a similar bill from kind of from the left. Representative Pramila Jayapal from Washington has a version that would cover a full salary up to $100,000 for 3 months. And so these are the kind of the battle lines for the next set of bills here. My suspicion is that we are going to end up with something that looks a lot like the House bill, but with some Republican priorities, and probably will include the payroll tax or some version of the payroll tax cut to go along with it. But that's because that's how these bills get worked out, is everybody says, well, I want to spend my money. You want to spend your money. And they say, well, I don't want to spend your money. I don't want to, you know, like, I want to do my thing. And then they get together and they, in the end, negotiate, well, we'll all spend most of the money that we want to spend. And that's how it's going to go here.
You know, one of the things that is kind of amazing among, you know, all of the shifting kind of rationales for everything we're doing, people have been talking about this, you know, the coronavirus pandemic is a war, we're on a war footing and stuff like that. And yet the government is acting as if its sole function is to keep everything normal. I mean, if you're talking about supporting people who are making 100 or 125 grand a year, you know, and so that they don't feel the pain, what the hell is going on? And if anything, we should acknowledge that we are going into an intense shutdown period where we're doing something and we're going to emerge, so that there's an urgency to actually get beyond this. At this point, everything is flattening the curve. Everything is just trying to keep things as normal as possible forever and ever. And it's completely unsustainable, but it also diffuses the need to actually change what we're doing so we can get to whatever the next wretched state of evolution is.
You know, a thing that I just want to add is, like I said, I have said on this podcast that if there is something that has made me question my priors, if there is a sort of big picture divergence from where I've traditionally been at, it has been on fiscal policy. In the past, I have generally been opposed to big stimulus packages under President Obama and under Bush. And I've thought, you know, without endorsing any of the things that we have specifically done, this crisis is different in a lot of ways. At the same time, one way that this has confirmed my priors is that the government has designed and implemented the actual response that we have had in such an incredibly shoddy way. We have spent so much money to such poor effect, and we are now going to probably end up spending at least $1 trillion more on this. And so, you know, while I can see a case kind of hypothetically in a world in which the U.S. federal government is pretty good at spending money well, and we know where it goes, and it's relatively effective, the actual practical design of these programs, which are inevitably just rushed out kind of self-contradictory, built on a bunch of competing priorities, some of which are partisan, some of which are ideological, that don't work together and don't always make sense. These bills end up being terrible. And they end up being even the parts of it that you might think, oh, that's, I can see that that provision, that program might be kind of a good idea. Then they get the Small Business Administration to run it, and it's terrible.
You know what you sound like? You sound like me on the Iraq War.
Wow.
Seriously.
While you were working for the Weekly Standard.
I was going to say, I
was working for the Weekly Standard, but I was a libertarian and I was skeptical of state power just as much then as I am now. But I said, well, this seems like it might be a case where a limited, competently executed international, hey, isn't the one thing the state is supposed to do if you're if you really have a minimalist view of the state, like they should be able to keep an army together and functional. Maybe they could just use that army. I mean, Madeleine Albright's right. We got it. Let's use it. And we could just, you know, free millions of people from the tyranny of a murderous dictator. If we just do it moderately well, I said, just kind of okay, it still might be a huge gain for global liberty. I was wrong. I was wrong because of the maybe they could just do it moderately well part, as well as some other reasons. But you sound like me on the Iraq War.
And the military is in many ways the more effective just in terms of implementation part
sure.
of the government.
They're much better at their job than like anyone doing anything vis-a-vis the economy. And it's still a nightmare.
Catherine, the four bills, the phase three to 0 to 3.5, whatever the hell.
Yep.
By my rough eyeballing it, because it's kind of hard to figure out how to measure unanimous votes when you know that some of the people didn't really want to vote for it. But the combined...
But they did.
No, but like Justin Amash said, that he went in and physically yes. recorded a no vote yep. on the... etc.
I count that as a no vote.
Well, that but, Wikipedia does
I'm
not.
I'm sorry. I,
thank you for derailing me yes. yet again, Nick Gillespie. No, fact-checking me.
I'm the underminer.
The combined vote of the four bills in the House of Representatives was something like 1,580 to 50. The combined vote in the Senate was something like 380 to 50, because on one of them, there's like 40 Republicans who said, come on. So, speaking of Justin Amash, he says that politics in Washington is a lot of bitter disagreements over stuff that doesn't matter. And then in moments of crisis, the parties get together and agree on big stuff almost unanimously. That's actually super damaging. So I occasion you to reflect on that, both in terms of financial stimulus and such, and the Iraq War and your own sense of personal guilt. And is Justin Amash just right? And are we all doomed?
Yeah, we are. That's my quick answer. Yeah, no, this happens every time. And you are right. And he is right to point out that a sign that something was both rushed and will have potentially extremely dangerous long term consequences is a overwhelming bipartisan vote in favor of the thing, unfortunately. And, you know, I've been thinking back and writing about the reaction after 9/11 and after the financial crisis. And it's the same. It's the same. You get giant new bureaucracies with massive new powers employing tens of thousands of additional people, all to the end of a poorly thought out, poorly structured response to a crisis that the outlines of which are virtually never clear when the initial legislation is passed. And I think, you know, the fact that like maybe now 2.5 months on, Josh Hawley has like stumble bunnied his way into the least horrible thing is a great illustration of how broken this process is, because it's too late. It's too late to even think about being like, maybe for a minute we should pause and listen to Josh Hawley, listen to what Josh Hawley has to say. And like, that's an upsetting concept all by itself. But it doesn't matter, both because his thing isn't going to happen, and because even if his thing did happen, it would only be a layer of icing on top of the cake of darkness.
Oh boy.
LOL. Eat Arby's. Nick, both you and yeah. and Peter sort of hinted at that, you know, normally you might hear some kind of rhetorical opposition from Republicans about this and that, fiscal policies, whatever. But that has gone out the window. I am going to invite you to think about that in terms of our initial operating metaphor as given to us by Chuck Schumer.
I thought we were going to use the cake thing.
Yeah. I thought we were going to use the Avengers thing.
Yeah, the cake.
Mute.
Well, I was thinking Crisis on Infinite Earths, or I was going to try and rope it back into Man in the High Castle. Because I think the last timeline where government was efficient was the one where the Axis won World War II.
I'm going to mute all of you.
If you remember Crisis on Infinite Earths,
because you don't know
especially
how.
Peter.
If you remember Crisis on Infinite Earths, the whole thing was designed to retcon a whole bunch of contradictory storylines that had built up over, what, like 20 years of nonsense DC
actually
continuity.
That's the occult reading of it, though, is that it was to stimulate the economy by creating a whole number of new titles that you constantly had to be reading. Matt, I will take it to the New Deal metaphor.
This is how I want you to address it, Nick, is that the New Deal invited it kind of while, you know, bulldozing American life and political life in particular, and obviously FDR was elected 4 times to be president, try to pack the court and whatnot. But it also defined the right and conservatism. First, it was the old right. Then it became kind of the new right. Mm-hmm. Opposition to the New Deal was part of the thing. Reagan,
now it's the
canned history that I'm providing here, which feel free to correct. Reagan kind of made his arm's length peace structurally with the New Deal while still kind of arguing against it. He'd made his career arguing against it. Neoconservatives, Catherine's friends, actually completely made their peace with the New Deal. It's like, yeah, you know, that's just an accepted part of American life. We're now at the phase, are we not, where the right, the Republican Party, some of this predates Trump, but it's definitely accelerated by him considering how he ran in 2016. That's vanished. Like that sense of, it's more like the New Deal now, we want to control it. I mean, the fact that the Trump still pines for his $1 trillion infrastructure deal as a way to unite the country to this day, he still wants to have Infrastructure Week, is a sign that the New Deal as a oppositional metaphor is gone. So I invite you to reflect on that and what it means when that it no longer is with us and there isn't that sense of any kind of tethering against what the kids used to call the welfare state.
Yeah. You know, okay. So a lot there. Let me kind of go back to something Catherine was getting at, which, you know, is the doom of, I think that there is a plausible case to be made that sometime in the past 2 months, we will recognize in the future at some point that we crossed the threshold into a world that is not unlike what happened when Hoover got routed in the 1932 election and Roosevelt took over, and that suddenly an entire history, an entire genealogy, an entire political understanding just disappeared. The old right essentially was gone. A version of America that included Democrats and Republicans, but it was gone and it was replaced by a triumph where the whole world was, you know, had something to do with massive government growth. Where I think that we may have done that, you know, we've been living within a kind of long New Deal mentality anyway, because Reagan was not opposed to the New Deal. Reagan campaigned and governed as a New Deal Democrat. He called himself an FDR Democrat, a New Deal Democrat. The Republicans, you know, everybody has been living in that, but we have now entered a new phase where when the government can effectively spend, you know, $3 trillion in a 6-week period on a budget that was originally $4.8 trillion, and we know it's going to be bigger and bigger. Where I'm hopeful is that from a libertarian perspective, there is this question of, you know, you want to restrain the growth of government because spending reflects a centralization of power and taking away autonomy from individuals and from the groups they form. At the same token, you know, if we think of government as a chronic infection or centralization as a chronic infection and libertarian ideas kind of try to mitigate that in all circumstances, the struggle isn't over. It just takes a different form. And this is where I think Amash, I find it persuasive when he says he's not saying the government wouldn't be spending or shouldn't be spending or couldn't be spending, but that it should be going to individuals rather than entities. We can argue with, you know, the efficacy of that or anything, but it gives us a way of talking about what does a libertarian, you know, politics of the future look like? And it is restraining stuff as much as possible. It's important to note that after the New Deal and after the World War II spending, which was massive, there was a massive retrenchment of government spending and a period of, you know, massive growth, economic growth, social growth, cultural liberation. That's what we need to be working towards. And we need to be undermining the, you know, the lack of effectiveness of all of these government programs that are going on, but also then pushing to that moment of when do we declare victory and cut spending, you know, the way that we did with VE and VJ.
Which the 75th anniversary of which was just last week. And pour a 40 out. Let's switch topics from coronavirus because damn it, aren't we all a little bit tired from it? And so I invite all of us to bring to the table, to the round table, if you will, a news item that is of interest, potentially, to listeners in the world, that is non-coronavirus related, yet still worthy of attention. Catherine, can you go first as the editor-in-chief of All Reasons Journalism?
I would love to. And in fact, I will be talking about the story that was the second most trafficked story on our site this last week, which was the arrest and mistreatment of a woman in a stormtrooper costume outside of a pizza joint.
A Star Wars stormtrooper, right? Not a Nazi stormtrooper.
Yes, a Star Wars stormtrooper outside of a pizza joint called Coco Vanilla Galactic Cantina in Alberta.
Because she is all of us. Like, never have I felt closer to the subject of any news story ever.
Absolutely. When I heard, as I did on the video of this incident, her weeping as she lay face down in a parking lot with several police officers around her as they attempted to ascertain whether the quote unquote weapon she was holding while wearing a costume was real, she was me. We were her. We were all together in it. It's just, it's like, it was May 4th. So it was you know,
happy May the 4th be with you.
Happy holidays to my Star Wars buddies out there. And just the very idea of this really is such a perfect encapsulation of the ways in which we have gotten law enforcement so very, very wrong. And I urge everyone to go to Reason and watch the video because it's a classic example of a kind of just a citizen driving by who sees what's going on, whips out the camera, takes some heat for it. Like, there's an interaction with one of the officers where, you know, they at the very least do say you're allowed to film, but don't get close or we'll arrest you for interfering, something like that. That was the only bright spot in this video, by the way, was the fact that more and more police officers at this point do understand that people have the right to film. Clearly, there have now been enough trainings. There have now been enough, you know, probably like paid suspensions, God help us, of people violating that officers do know that. But yeah, there's not even a huge, you know, ta-da takeaway from this except for to just watch it. In this case, the costume and the fact that it's Canada gives you a little distance to kind of appreciate the absurdity and maybe even the humor. But of course, this happens every single day to ordinary people in the United States and in Canada with much less humorous and much less ultimately salutary results. So Star Wars costume lady did not have a real gun, in case anyone was wondering.
We are all face down in the parking lot of life, sobbing uncontrollably.
With a jackboot on our neck. Yeah.
Suderman.
While wearing a Star Wars stormtrooper costume.
Besides obviously impersonating a lady wearing a Star Wars stormtrooper costume in Canada recently. What is
How did you get to Alberta, Peter?
What is a newsworthy news item that you would like to alert Reason Roundtable listeners to?
Disneyland in Shanghai has reopened, and they have reopened they have government imposed capacity limits that are, I believe, about a third of what they normally would allow. And Disney has said that at first they will not even be allowing the park to get to the government imposed capacity. So it's still, it's even less than that is what's actually allowed in. However, the tickets that went on sale sold out in just a couple of hours. And so you can see photos of people walking around in like princess dresses and face masks at Disney in Shanghai. Apparently the characters, like the animal, you know, Mickey Mouse and whatnot, they're all social distancing from each other, but they are also performing their big shows. And so they reopened and performed their big, you know, nighttime show, Fantasmic, to start this thing, right? Like, and people are kind of excited about this, and it is a little sign of hope that, like, some of the weird cultural oddities that, like, connect us and bind us globally might come back, maybe not in exactly the capacity or form they were in before, but that there's a future out there. And Shanghai is, you know, is ahead of us on this in terms of going through this thing. And so it is it's something to look at and say, well, we're not going to be stuck in this situation that we are in today in the middle of May forever. And so I probably won't end up going to a Disney park again in my life, but I'm very, very glad that there is one right now that is open and available for people to go to.
I now have a mental image of a 5-year-old girl in a Disney princess dress and a Bane mask. Face first in the parking lot of Disney, wherever hell, crying.
Look, if I can go and wear like a Darth Vader mask, you know, for the and have that be my COVID-19 protection thing, right? If like an N95 Darth Vader system with sound effects built in.
I mean, let's be real. If that doesn't exist, I was going to say, if that doesn't already exist, like, it's in production right now.
It does now. Yeah. Yeah. By the end of this recording.
If you think that Elon Musk doesn't have one for his entire family.
Can we pause, though, and say congratulations
for his vanity license plate baby?
New baby that is named letters that don't really exist.
I was hoping that you had already instilled this to memory.
Yeah, no, we have to talk about it briefly. I was tricked by the internet joke that it was actually pronounced Kyle. Like somebody, because it's like an X, and it was like, that's like Kai, and then like the A-E, you know, stuck together thing, which I forget that's called.
So do we still not know
it's
the pronunciation?
It's actually like X Ash Archangel or something like that. It's just as bananas as it looks and as you feared.
Nick, can you have a non-Disney intellectual copyright related news item?
Yeah, where I mean, in many ways, isn't the dark future is where the only parks that are open are Disney parks?
Yeah.
Ouch.
You know, I mean, they're already merchandising our dreams.
I am face first crying.
I can't sleep because I'm afraid that I will dream of Mickey Mouse and Pluto. So what I'm interested in, and this goes to that question of like, whenever, you know, various forms of centralization or repression are going on, there's all kinds of other stuff that becomes possible. And over the past several years, but especially over the past year or so, there have been a number of laws at the state level pushing for either the decriminalization or legalization of psychedelics, psilocybin mushrooms, things like MDMA, psychedelic adjacent substances. New York lawmaker about a week ago introduced a bill to decriminalize magic mushrooms. Something like that had happened in Vermont last year and Iowa. Cities such as Oakland, California, and Santa Cruz and Denver have already decriminalized this. There is a growing psychedelic movement that is, you know, making real progress as a lot of 20th century kind of prohibitions and mentalities are just kind of falling by the wayside, either because the people who were worried about that have died or because we got bigger things to worry about right now. There is, and I'll tie this in very quickly to sad news of the day. But there's a great new Netflix documentary that is called Have a Good Trip, and it's a bunch of musicians like Sting, Shams like Deepak Chopra, and comedians like Sarah Silverman talking about their experiences with psychedelics. It's a really fascinating look at the good and the bad and the ugly of psychedelic experiences. And it has this great moment. It's streaming on Netflix as of today. And it has a great anecdote from Ben Stiller, the actor whose father was Jerry Stiller, who played Frank Costanza in Seinfeld. And Ben Stiller says he took LSD once and he started tripping and he freaked out. So he called his parents, Ann Mira, the comedian, and Jerry Stiller, Frank Costanza. And, you know, can you imagine tripping on LSD and you call Frank Costanza? And he's like, Dad, I just did acid. And he's like, you know, you just drank battery acid? Why did you do that? And like, I mean, that just is a kind of wonderful moment and a way of remembering Jerry Stiller, as well as also kind of thinking about what comes next as the world and America becomes less hung up over what substances we use to kind of manipulate and change our consciousness. So I would, you know, that's one of the things I've been following, and I would check out Have a Good Trip on Netflix if you're at all interested in this.
I will volunteer as mine news over the weekend that our colleague Brian Doherty painstakingly, perhaps painfully, logged on. He sat through an 8-plus hour Zoom meeting of the Libertarian National Committee, I think it was.
I experienced that mostly via his Slack posts about being logged on to that Zoom meeting, and that was too much for me. Like, yeah, I just was like, I'll just wait and see what he says at the end, because even watching him Slack the Zoom in real time is a nightmare.
Talk about a bad psychedelic experience. That would be tough to spin yourself out of.
While he was doing that, I was imagining, I loved in the new Star Wars movies or the second trilogy, the scenes of the Galactic Senate, you know, just endlessly talking about stoplights on Tatooine or something. And that's what that was.
The long and the short of it is that the Libertarian Party has decided to nominate its president and vice presidential nominees over the Memorial Day weekend via Zoom or some other kind of online participation, which is a big change. Originally, they had scheduled an in-person convention in Austin, Texas for May 21st to May 25th. That got canceled because of the coronavirus. And then there was a lot of confusion and still apparently is. And they've divorced the other convention business, such as electing a new national chairman and various other members of the LNC board and I presume their platform functions and stuff like that will take place at a convention in Orlando, speaking of Disney properties, July 8th through the 12th. So that they've decided to do it. There's essentially 2 weeks to figure out who the Libertarian nominee is going to be. And to that end, I watched on Saturday night, Libertarian Party of Kentucky held a presidential debate. It was the first one involving the late entrant Justin Amash. So it was kind of interesting to see how Amash sounds like in the context of an LP debate and who attacks him and why, or who doesn't. Jacob Hornberger, who has been heretofore the front runner of the campaign, he won 6 or 7, depending on how you count, non-binding primaries and caucuses of the 9 or 10 that have been held, and has been doing a pretty good job. He went all out after Amash, you know, saying that he's basically a reform conservative Republican who accepts as a starting point the warfare welfare state instead of trying to be a hardcore libertarian. And, you know, the principle and the message is the most important thing. He said that he would not pledge to endorsing Amash should he win the nomination. So it's pretty interesting. And it's also interesting to see Amash in that circumstance, being very kind of unflappable sitting congressman with media experience, finishing off his answers before the allotted time. It's fascinating. You can go and watch it up on YouTube. I think, Nick, you were watching or trying to watch some of it.
I watched it eventually, and I was impressed most with Vermin Supreme, who took the boot off his head and actually made some Interesting answers.
As someone who's moderated two or three of these debates and also additionally interviewed Vermin Supreme for a forthcoming magazine, a little interview, he's interesting cat. There's a reason why he's won a couple of these. And yes, it's the boot and the mandatory toothbrushing and the free ponies for all. But he's got a coherent rap, regardless of whether you think it's the appropriate one to have at this time. But anyways, that's...
Can I ask you, Matt, how would you rank Amash's performance?
I think that he did what he needed to do, which is survive and also provide a rationale for a type of libertarianism that appeals to people who are not now self-identified as libertarians, either with a small or capital L. He made the point that you need to do, the point of running elections is to try to win. And I think a lot of the people who were backing Jacob Hornberger and attacking Amash, people like Comic Dave Smith, Tom Woods from the Mises Institute in Auburn, Alabama, their point is more that we're going to lose, so we might as well, you know, die with our boots on and have more
our heads
purely distilled version of libertarianism. Amash made the argument against that, and I think he did that in an effective way. But you know, others will have differing opinions.
I agree with that, Matt. I think, you know, one of the, and it might be a turning point for the Libertarian Party where they shed the idea that they're mostly informational. When the party was founded in 1971, with the exception of Reason and a couple of other smaller publications, there really wasn't that much of a libertarian intellectual or philosophical infrastructure in place. And now there is, and that really... The LP, rather than serving as a kind of tutorial in, you know, libertarianism 101, might actually be able to shift to something approaching what political parties traditionally and conventionally
It's certainly
do.
An unresolved question to this day that has plagued them from the beginning. Are we an educational movement or organ, or are we a political party, or like what's the role between that? There's a piece I wrote for the magazine about 2 or 3 years ago that kind of riffs on a statement that Tom Woods made at the 2018 national convention or adjacent to it. It's like, would you rather have 70 million votes or would you rather have 1 million converts? He didn't use the word convert, but basically to that effect. And it's an actually interesting question. And there are interesting answers associated with it. I also came away thinking that some of the attraction, both to Hornberger, but certain types of libertarianism are as much to kind of in-your-face, abrasive personality. I don't normally associate Jacob with that.
You're only coming to this after...
Really? Yeah, I was
when did you
say,
start working at Reason, Nick, Matt Welch? Right? I mean, yeah. I'm the least abrasive... I'm certainly not abrasive from a first
principles point of view. Libertarians
are all
easy going. No, the thing that's interesting about this dynamic that you're describing is it's not just about winning versus kind of ideological purity. It's also about candidate quality, right? And this is a thing that that political scientists and kind of consultant types will talk about, is that candidate quality matters. And so even if Justin Amash doesn't win, as he is not going to, what someone like Justin Amash can do is provide a model, provide a kind of a sense of a pathway for higher quality candidates who can appeal to more people and have a better shot down the road. And I think that's one of the arguments, you know, for a Justin Amash candidacy and for his approach to libertarian politics.
And he makes that argument pretty explicitly of that. Go, Nick.
Oh, I was going to say, you know, Judge Jim Gray, who was also in that debate, made similar points. And you know, there this idea that you can either have 70 million votes or a million converts. First off, it's orders of magnitude off. It's like you can have 4 million votes or 40 converts, probably. But beyond that, it is, you know, what I think candidates like Gary Johnson and Bill Weld, you know, nobody's rigid doctrinaire version of libertarians do. You know, they widen the circle. Somebody like Amash does. Amash has become the first libertarian congressman, which is kind of fascinating. And, you know, I suspect he will also be the last libertarian congressman. But you know, it opens up possibilities. And this is, I mean, if you know, I am now fully, this part probably goes back to the magic mushroom conversation.
It always does.
I'm fully living in one of the timelines of Man in the High Castle, the Amazon series. And, you know, by having these possibilities out there, they have the potential to become the basis. I've also been watching a lot of Rick and Morty, which is completely meta in the new season. But they become, you know, kind of the germ of an idea or the early crystal that then can, you know, kind of grow and proliferate into a whole other universe. So, you know, it's a false dichotomy to say we can either be pure or we can win. It's more like, can you get more people to think in terms that you're thinking? And what effect does that have? And I think that has always been what American politics is about. It's not about these revolutions. Franklin Roosevelt with the New Deal, that was coming out of a 19th century tradition that then transformed into progressivism in the early 20th century and took root even as the 20s were beginning, which we talk about as this rescission of government. But that's not true at all. Like, even though it was an era of laissez-faire, government grew, it becomes something else. And I think the function of libertarian ideas is really to act as both a counterweight, but to be guiding, you know, the battleship, as opposed to tearing everything down and then living in, you know, a varieties of gulches where you can't, you know, your satellite dish has to be a certain dimension. Otherwise, the local police get to push you face down in a parking lot. Like a Stormtrooper
in the parking lot. Let's shift to our.
Yeah, I wasn't. Crying was not very convincing.
Let's shift to our end of show media consumption. I'm going to request lovingly that maybe we limit them to one instead of a multi-part series.
We all Peter got Suderman. A little carried away last week, and I think I can speak for us all when we say.
I don't think I did. I don't think Matt did either. I don't think. I think the two
I mean,
of you.
Yeah. There was some monologuing by all parties, I would say.
Catherine, show us the model version of how one might answer the question of what media you've been consuming.
Lead by example.
I will lead by example. I played Zoom Scattergories this week. And it was great. So every single one of you is shaking your heads right now, but it's sad that you're haters because I have found joy in I found love in a hopeless place, and it's fun. So Scattergories was definitely a staple of my 80s and 90s childhood. It is also not coincidentally a game that I am excellent at, which is why I enjoyed it so much, because I'm a bad person. And there's a very good way to play it on Zoom. There's a link. It's nicely formatted. You do a screen share and you can play in teams if there's someone else in your house or not, if there's not. And I recommend it as a game with good low online overhead and also short iterations. So you can play like one round or two rounds or three rounds and then be done because you have to go to bed because you're exhausted from homeschooling your children, working all day and washing your hands all the time.
That's how I feel about Battlefield 5's squad conquest mode.
Mm.
Have you done that on Zoom,
stroking
Peter?
Out there for a second. Yeah. Nick, what psychedelics have you been consuming?
Yep. I read a very good novel that I highly recommend called Such a Fun Age by Kylie Reed. It's a first novel set in Philadelphia, and it follows a young black woman who is a babysitter or kind of nanny for a wealthy white family where the mother is a kind of Instagram thinkfluencer type. And it's very much, it's been compared to Sally Rooney's Normal People. It is similar in many ways. There's romance, there's a huge class component, but it adds race to the mix, and which makes it, and it's in America, it's a really fantastic kind of scenario where you have race, class, and gender mixing in a very combustible way. It's a novel that starts out strong and gets better and more interesting. I don't know that it's great literature, but I don't really care about that. And it's really a great piece of writing to be reading at this
Nick,
current
breaking
moment.
News. as tweeted at me, not that I wasn't listening to every word, I wasn't looking at, hey, by Young Americans for Liquor, breaking, New York Governor Cuomo confirms May 15th is the end of the statewide closure in New York. That's it, Nick. We can break out. We can finally leave.
All right, baby. We got 4 days, Matt. Can we stand?
I'm confused, though, about this. Am I wrong to think more people have it now than had it when we all happily quarantined ourselves at the very beginning? Yeah. I mean, it's more dangerous.
Stopping
now.
The ventilators.
Well, no. You're more likely to get infected, yes. You mean.
Yeah. We're just flattening the curve and stopping the bed bugs.
But ma'am, what does that even mean? I guess is my question.
What does it mean, though, that he's lifting?
Can we go back to
Madison Square Garden? I was just going to say, so Madison Square Garden is going to reopen. We're going to have monster truck shows.
This means that the playground around the corner can finally open.
What, you've been lonely there, Matt? You're the only one there. The kids are all in shelter.
It's like
in place.
Lanny Friedlander's Where Have All the Children Gone? Essay, which haunts me to this day.
Yeah, where have they gone?
In all seriousness. Yeah, no. Peter Suderman, what one piece of media have you been consuming?
I have been playing the video game Control. For those who understand the words I'm about to say, it is a third-person action Metroidvania, which means that it combines...
Those are real words.
Yes, it's totally true, which means that it combines gameplay elements from the classic video games Metroid and Castlevania, except in this case, in a third-person kind of modern, quasi-open-world situation. In this game, you play a character who seems to be having... some sort of traumatic psychic or psychological issues, who becomes at the very beginning of the game the director of a federal agency that investigates paranormal and occult phenomena. It is the Federal Bureau of Control. It's just a smart, spooky, well-written video game and story. Has a very intriguing player character who's in a lot of these video games, you often have like a guide character who's like calling you on a telephone or a radio and kind of telling you what to do. But in this case, it's her own internal monologue talking to, well, she keeps saying you. And it's actually unclear if she's who the you is in this, except that maybe she's actually talking to you, the player who is controlling her. The other thing that's really interesting about this is that you start the game in an anonymous city and you walk into the Federal Bureau of Control, the building. And so the whole game is built around federal design principles, and all of these buildings all like, or the interior of it all actually really feels like you're walking around HUD or HHS or something like that, except a sort of much larger and even creepier version. And it just makes really effective use of the actually creepy, weird, brutalist architecture that you see in a lot of federal office buildings in Washington, D.C. It's a great game if you like single player games like BioShock or The Last of Us. Anything along those lines, would highly recommend it.
Do you get to go outside of the building, or is it all like, I gotta get this memo off my desk.
In the first third of the game, which is all I've played, you start outside, and then the game gives you control of the character the moment your player character steps into the lobby. And so there's no moment at which you leave the building, although the building does prove to be much more expansive than you would normally think for one of these things. I mean, like, but Lord knows what sort of psychic, you know, engines are being held in the basement of HHS in real life.
So my entrance, Little Richard died over the weekend, the great early rock pioneer. He had one of the 5 or 10 claims to be, you know, the king of rock and roll or the originator of rock and roll.
The queen. He claimed to be both the king and queen of rock and
roll.
Which
is just phenomenal on every level. I've been going down a little bit of a rabbit hole, not too much, but the place that I would recommend that people start for fun about not just music, but American character and post-war this and that, race, and especially sex, but also music, is Bill Wyman, the great rock critic, friend of Nick and myself, wrote a piece for Vulture.com with a crappy headline, Little Richard put Wild Sex into the top 40 for good, which underestimates the just phenomenally detailed look it has on kind of the role that like ecstasy or ecstatic expression played in Little Richard Richard's career, but also in the kind of birth of rock and roll, starting with his famous song Tutti Frutti. He had been recording, and I didn't know all this stuff. I'm not really super into all the 50s rocker people all that much.
So we're bringing it back to the backdoor metaphor that I think Peter started talking about at the beginning of this
the I wrote it down actually because I want to use it for later because it's super good.
The backdoor UBI caucus
yeah. is just the my new
Little Richard wrote their theme song.
They're trying to sneak it in through the kitchen, right, in a long tracking shot. You guys know what
he
I'm talking
been,
about.
He had been...
This is almost like a literal depiction of Tutti Frutti, Peter Sederman.
Tutti Frutti, interestingly enough, which has the wop-bop-a-loop-a-wop-bam-boom of Top Secret fame. He had been recording and kind of ineffectually, people had always seen his talent and his charisma, but he hadn't really captured it on vinyl. And he was recording in New Orleans and it wasn't really clicking. And they went to a bar and he went up to a piano and he just belted this craziness out, incredibly bawdy, homosexualist, awesome, super sex carnal thing out. And the record producer said, oh, I think we might have something here. And hence Rock and Roll was born, version 17.3. Anyways.
It's good that at least it wasn't in a public library so that the national conservatives really have no standing. It was in a private business.
Still, David French does nothing.
Still, he does nothing. Yeah. No, what's great about reading
Pat
this bill?
Boone covers Tutti Frutti, and yet David French does nothing. Christian.
It's great going through this very detailed thing because it's filled with YouTube links of like Little Richard on the Dick Cavett show in the early 70s, just dressed in the most incredible, like 70s lady gown, blouse, pantsuit. Combo with a oh my god, it's just so good. So go there and go to the various offshoots, whether they're these bawdy and completely unreliable historically speaking oral histories of his life, and he's ping-ponging back and forth between being the queen of rock and roll and then being the super religious person who condemns homosexuality and gets married. And it's just crazy and wonderful, and I love the way that despite every attempt from our new TradCon friends to suppress it, like Little Richard just became this thing that America, like, yep, that's it. That's Little Richard. And and that's, you know, in 1957, this dude was, during his first retirement, was already just this known crazy pompadour sequin blouse wearing beautiful insane person, and I love all of it. So go check out Bill Wyman. All right, that's all the checking out we have time to do for this Pod Tableist podcast. What? And go to reason.com/podcast, get a load of that Nick Gillespie creature and all of his Wednesdays, and also Soho Forum, which is crazy and virtual and fun. And we'll catch you next week, and we will have less doom and less New Deal, I swear, but I don't. Face first in a parking lot sobbing. Goodbye.